This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Catherine Min is a writer. Her first novel, Secondhand World, was published last year to critical acclaim. Secondhand World was a finalist for the Penn Bingham Award, an honor given to exceptionally talented fiction writers for a first work. Named by a number of critics as one of the best debuts of 2006, it was named by School Library Journal as one of the best adult books for high school students. Publishers Weekly described the novel as haunting, a depiction of a tragedy-beset Korean-American family living in upstate New York during the aftermath of the Korean War. Catherine Min is a native of Champaign-Urbana, and she is back in town as a University of Illinois Carr visiting author. She's also visiting us here this afternoon on the program, The Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with her about her childhood in Champaign-Urbana, the novel Secondhand World, her short stories, and what she's currently at work on. And she will also read some excerpts from Secondhand World. Listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon for Catherine Min. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Catherine Min's short stories have appeared in many publications and anthologies, most recently in the anthology game, The Pushcart Book of Stories, the best short stories from a quarter century of the Pushcart Prize. Her first novel, Secondhand World, will be out in paperback from Anchor Books in January. The hardcover edition is published by Knopf. And you can learn more about our guest at her website, www.CatherineMin.com, and Catherine is spelled with a K. Later this afternoon, on this, the 7th of November, Catherine Min will read from her work in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. That's on the second floor of the bookstore on South Wright Street in Champaign. The reading is set for 4:30. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So what was it like growing up in Champaign-Urbana?
Well, you know, I feel like it's a little bit of false advertising in a way. I was born in Carlton Hospital, which I don't know if it still exists.
Oh, Carl Hospital?
Carl Hospital, yeah, mm-hmm. In Urbana, but moved from Champaign-Urbana when I was 1.5.
Oh.
So I don't have a lot of memories. My father was a graduate student at University of Illinois. He got his PhD in physics and then stayed to teach for a little bit, and then we moved to Virginia. So I have, you know, I'm 1.5. I feel like I have some early memories. I think I absorbed something.
Really?
but not very much.
Yeah. Well, what do your parents have to say about their time in Champaign-Urbana?
You know, I think it was a really wonderful time for them. I mean, they were newly married. My brother and myself, you know, were born here, and you know, my father was just starting out in his career. You know, they were immigrants who came right after the Korean War, and I think it was a very exciting time, but it was also, you know, a somewhat difficult time for them. Just starting over in a new country is a very difficult thing.
Yeah. And that is also at heart of Secondhand World, that story of the Korean immigrant story, in particular in the 50s and 60s. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But I want to talk with you a little bit about, I want to get listeners more acquainted with you. You're a graduate of Amherst and the Columbia School of Journalism. And I was wondering if a career in journalism was something that you considered.
Oh, absolutely. When I was at Columbia, in fact, I was very much encouraged to go into radio or television. But I was there, I have very vocationally minded parents. A lot of Korean parents are very, you know, practical minded. And I knew I wanted to be a fiction writer from the time I was very, very young. And my parents just said, you know, do something practical, get a degree in something that you can actually get a job in. And then, you know, you can always write fiction if you want to. So with that in mind, I went to journalism school. I think it was an excellent thing to do. I supported myself through journalism for a number of years, but always knew that I wanted to be a fiction writer and always kept writing. And I think, you know, honestly, if I'd stayed in journalism, I probably would have ended up like Stephen Glass because I like to make things up and I didn't like to be too tied down to the actual facts.
Well, one of these days, though, you could come around and decide you're going to write a work of literary nonfiction.
Oh, that's
I think you would be fabulous.
No, I think about that sometimes. I teach a memoir writing class and but, you know, I like to make things up too much, I think.
Well, on your website, there's a little interview with you, and you told the interviewer you were incorrigible at lying when you were a kid. What kind of lies did you tell?
Oh, whoppers. you know, I would tell lies where it was very impractical to do so. For example, my mother was 9 months pregnant with my brother, and I was at a birthday party, and my mother was going to pick me up in 5 minutes, and I told the woman who was hosting the birthday party that my mother had had twins, you know, the week before. And she was sort of surprised and she was like, oh, wow, that's great. And then my mother shows up and she's clearly still 9 months pregnant. So things like that. I mean, just not even for any reason other than I just could.
Yeah.
And I knew that the only way that I would end up either not in jail or, you know, really in serious trouble was, you know, to sort of funnel that into something. So I started writing fiction, you know, really very, very young when I was, I think it was my first grade teacher who said that I was going to be a writer.
Wow. What kinds of things were you writing as a six-year-old or a five-year-old? A
lot of stories. I wrote my first novel when I was 12, which I still have. It's about a woman with 17 children living in London, England. You know, I've never been to London, England, but you know, I just had this incredible imagination, and I was a very sort of bookish child, very dreamy. I tell people when I was 11 years old, and other girls that I knew were dreaming of their wedding day or prom, I was dreaming about having, you know, a Borzoi book with Knopf, which is exactly what happened to me many, many years later. But that's what I cared about. You know, I cared about books and about ideas.
Yeah. What kinds of books did you like to read as a girl?
You know, I read a lot of things that were probably inappropriate for me to have read at the time. But just anything I could get my hands on. I remember not being able to sleep for 2 weeks after I got a hold of a copy of The Boston Strangler, you know, when I was about, I don't know, 10 or 11. I read, you know, everything from Nancy Drew to, I think I read a lot of, you know, when I was young, I really loved Kurt Vonnegut. I loved Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, just a wide range of writers.
Yeah. And then when you grew up, you were a little older, you're in college. What were you reading in college?
I loved British fiction. I really gravitated towards people like Thomas Hardy. I loved the Brontes, and I loved Tom Jones and Defoe. I mean, really sort of, you know, the old sort of classic stuff. And then later, you know, of course, Virginia Woolf, James Joyce. I was a real, I think, Anglophile in terms of my literary tastes for a long time.
Yeah. Well, now let's talk about Secondhand World. It opens with the narrator, the protagonist, introducing herself. Maybe you would read that section and then the section that follows, which is about this young woman's mother.
Yes, thanks. My name is Isadora Myonghee's son, and I'm 18 years old. I was recently 95 days in a pediatric burn unit at Tri-State Medical Center in Albany, New York, being treated for second and third degree burns on my legs, complicated by a recurring bacterial infection. The same fire that injured me killed my parents, Haegyeong Chung and Taemun Son, on June 11, 1976, at approximately 3:20 a.m. It's very isolating to recover from a severe burn injury. The pain requires a great deal of attention and inward focus. While your skin tissue rages and dies, you try and put yourself as far away as possible mentally to take refuge in small, retrievable thoughts. Nursery rhymes are sometimes useful, as are television theme songs and knock-knock jokes. Here's a riddle. A jumbo jet takes off from New York en route to Vancouver with 246 people on board. There's a massive snowstorm. Visibility worsens. Passengers pray and panic. The pilot loses control and the plane ends up doing a nosedive on the border of the United States and Canada. The weather is so bad it takes the rescue helicopters 2 days to get to the remote crash site in the mountains. When they finally manage to land, amid the snow and the wreckage, they're confronted with a terrible dilemma. Since the plane crashed exactly on the boundary line separating the two countries, the recovering authorities don't know whether to bury the survivors in Canada or the United States. It took me a while to get it. The trick is knowing where to focus. There's so much clamor and confusion, the plane, the storm, the panic, that you're easily thrown off. You end up overlooking what you should have noticed right away. The fact is that survivors aren't buried. They keep walking around. They go through the varied motions of normalcy, trying to forget the screams, the shudder of the fuselage, the sound of crumpling metal, the frozen wait among the dead for rescue. Celluloid. Many years before the fire that killed my parents, there was another fire. In Seoul, Korea, my mother had grown up among a harem of sisters, hoarded like treasure, quarantined like contagion, inside a high wall that contained the buildings and courtyards of the Chung family compound. My grandfather was a high-ranking government official who spent most of his time carousing with Kisan girls and gambling at cards. My grandmother, herself the daughter of a high-ranking official, was terse and irritable, weighted by disappointment in birthing only girls. One night, when my mother was 11, a treat was set up in the cramped building where the servants slept. It was a viewing of one of the first silent films from America, obtained somehow by my grandfather, along with an ancient projector that wheezed and smoked as it threw its jangled images upon the wall. The room was hot and crowded, but my mother hardly noticed, so taken was she by the figures of the dancing women. They wore loose clothing that floated behind them as they danced, with emblematic jewelry and makeup that emphasized their wide eyes and sensual lips. Alabaster skin, marcelled hair piled high. My mother had never seen such women. Their serpentine sway, unaccompanied by music or sound of any kind, except the restless movement of the children and the hawking of the projector, was intricate, hypnotic. They were like Grecian goddesses come to life, like the sculpted caryatids my mother had once seen in a book in her father's library. She began to move along with them in time to the unheard music. Her older sister Heja pushed her away. "Sst," she whispered, pinching her hard on the underside of the upper arm. My mother huddled close to the projector. She watched as a strip of film wound around the metal spools in a tilting figure eight. Light from inside the machine streamed out toward the wall, thick with lolling dust. She looked up at the screen and then down to the projector again, trying to discover where they hid, these bright ladies, slender swaying columns of pure grace. The old projector sputtered and paused, and before the audience had time to protest, the dancers disappeared in a spreading sepia bubble. Both film and projector burst into flames. Children and servants began to scream as the room filled with smoke. My mother smelled something acrid and felt a strange prickling at the back of her neck. As the women had danced moments before, now the elderly Ajumma, who'd been attending the projector, danced in spasmodic rhythm, a flume of fire blooming across her chest. The sensation at the back of my mother's neck became a searing pain. Her head was on fire, and she fainted before she could push through, with the others, out of the room and into the dirt courtyard, where the adults ran with buckets of water. An old servant saved her. He rushed inside the room and doused the fire nestled in her hair, carrying her out in his arms. My grandmother, overwhelmed by daughters, disgraced by them, thought perhaps she would lose one that night, but my mother was not obliging. She survived with no major injury, just a spot the size of a quarter where her hair wouldn't grow, and a shiny purple scar, ropey and asymmetrical.
And those are the first two chapters of Catherine Min's book, Secondhand World. Thanks for reading those for us,
You're welcome, by the way.
Fire figures so prominently in this story. How did it come to you to do so much with fire? Why fire?
You know, I tell my students all the time that, you know, symbols are things that readers look for, that writers don't think about. So I wasn't consciously thinking. All I knew was that the novel was going to begin with a fire that has killed Issa's parents. And then after that, things just sort of fell into place in the way that, if you're lucky, serendipitously, things will happen in a novel. The mother's fire is what liberates her from what would have been a pretty confining traditional life in Seoul, Korea. And she gets sent off to a teacher's college in America because she's considered unmarriageable because of the scar. And for the mother, who, you know, is a very important figure in the book, she sees it as sort of a fortuitous omen, this idea of her, the fire liberating her. And for Issa, of course, it becomes a very different thing. And that her mother ends up dying by fire ends up figuring also very heavily into sort of the plot of the novel. And that Issa herself will have her own scars from this fire. Mm-hmm. Is interesting in that she and her mother have a very difficult, very close relationship that changes throughout the book. And Issa is going to end up seeing her scars very differently than her mother saw hers.
Yes, it's very interesting. There's a time there's a point in the novel where Issa is talking about her burns, and she says, you know, it's curious how one's skin tries to recover from a severe burn. It grows thick and gnarly, but really it's much more sensitive than one's skin before the burn. So she says, I have grown thin-skinned.
Right, right. And, you know, I had done a lot of research about burn injuries. And, in fact, it's true that the skin looks sort of corded and ropey,
right.
But that it becomes incredibly sensitive to anything, you know, cold, hot, wind. And, you know, Issa's burns are mostly on her legs. I play a lot in the novel with the idea of skin as being a boundary, being a barrier between ourselves and the world and mm-hmm. other people. There's a lot in the book about intimacy, about how close you can actually be to other people, and yet we are unable to escape sort of the barriers of our own skin.
Yeah. Skin also plays a role in terms of color.
Yes.
And Issa is Korean-American, and her boyfriend, Hiro, is an albino.
Right. And that's something that I think occurs in my work a lot, is this interest in the attraction to the other. And, you know, again, people say, well, why an albino? And not something that I had expected to happen. I had thought, you know, it made a lot of sense. Issa grows up in a neighborhood near Albany, New York, where there are no other Asian families. This is in the late 70s. So I assumed that her boyfriend would be Caucasian. But much to my surprise, he became sort of hyper white. And it sort of worked in a way, because Hiro is different, is considered sort of an outsider the way Issa is, but for obviously different reasons. And so they're drawn to each other for that reason. But the other reason that Issa's drawn to Hiro is because even though he's an albino, and therefore sort of more foreign even, you know, than being Asian, he really doesn't mind. He sort of sees it. He thinks of himself as a rock star, and he has a kind of a confidence that I think Issa wishes for herself. So she's drawn to him for that reason as well, because for Issa, being Asian in a predominantly Caucasian area is not comforting.
Right. And it's really tough for her. She gets called names at school, and she has a tough time on the bus, that kind of thing. So
right, and so she has a tough time at home because, you know, her parents, her father especially, expects her to be and to behave, you know, in sort of a more traditional Korean way. And Issa's nothing if not a rebel. She just wants to totally fit in and not be a traditional Korean daughter.
Yeah. There's a difference there. There's a little conflict there that we see between mother and father, in that he expects Koreanness and mom expects Americanness, and that's how she has kind of an unusual name.
Right.
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 It's a compromise.
Her mother wants to name her Isadora because her mother was a dancer, and Isadora Duncan was sort of her heroine. And the father names her Myung-hee, which is the traditional Korean name she would have had, you know, if she had been born in Korea. And so they call her Isadora Myung-hee Son. And everyone calls her Issa, except her father, who insists on calling her Myung-hee, and he's the only one who uses her Korean name.
Yeah. Now, the parents are, like Issa and Hiro, are kind of an unlikely couple too, right?
Yeah. The father is a very serious, he's a physics professor, very reticent. He doesn't talk. He's severe. He's withdrawn. To Issa, for most of the novel, he's a mystery, and a somewhat forbidding one. The mother is a great beauty. She has a very fragile personality, and there is a tragedy that occurs toward the beginning of the book that really throws her mother into, you know, I would say sort of a nervous breakdown, from which she's only tentatively recovering even towards the end of the book. So she's, you know, sort of a fragile plant. And yet the father adores her. And it's something that Issa doesn't really understand. For Issa, unfortunately, in the novel, she becomes sort of – there's sort of two threesomes. One is her mother, her father, and herself after her brother's death. And the other one is her boyfriend, her best friend, and herself. And Issa's always sort of feeling like she's the third wheel. Mm. And she never understands her parents' relationship, and that, in fact, leads to very tragic consequences.
Yeah. Also, though, that is so human. That's how kids are. We don't get it until, you know, who hasn't heard from a parent someday, right?
Yeah.
So, another thing that I'd like to talk with you about, and then we get to the mother-daughter relationship, is the role music plays in the novel. It's a soundtrack,
yes,
of sorts.
Yes.
And maybe you could maybe actually read this for us, but page 11, Issa's mother is tucking her young daughter into bed, and she sings to her. You want to read us a selection or a portion of that chapter?
My mother. Her eyes, when she was happy, glanced across a room like sunlight, dark center strewn with diamond facets. When she was unhappy, they seemed to retract beneath eyelids precisely outlined in liquid black, her look averted, cast down, all the giddy shine suddenly leached from the world. For most of my life, I watched her, ensorcelled by her beauty, by the daily acts of grace that were her movements. She peeled an apple by moving her thumb backward along the knife, her small hand seeming to float, to flutter, losing the skin in one long ribbon until it fell to the plate like a molted snakeskin. She raced down the aisles of the A&P, picking things up, red grapes, camembert cheese, salmon steak, and tossing them in the grocery cart as though she were on a TV game show. Tucking me in at night, she sang Raindrops on Roses or Que Sera Sera in perfect imitation of Doris Day. Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? My mother would lean in, her breath hot in my ear. Both, Issa, she would whisper, you'll be both. And I'd feel a chill run through me at the maternal prophecy.
Mm. The mother-daughter relationship is such a potent one. You want to tell us a little bit about the relationship between these two and contrast it to the relationship that Issa's mother had with her mother?
Yeah. You know, when I started the book, what I wanted to do was to show, in terms of this triangularity, I mean, for most of Issa's life, she's completely in love with her mother. Her mother is a great beauty. She's, as that excerpt showed, she's very exciting. She's a little impulsive, very, very enthusiastic, a little unstable, which comes out later. And the father is so sort of cold and really austere that Issa is either afraid of him or he's just not really factoring into her life. I was interested actually in the fact that Issa is not beautiful. She's very plain looking. And I was actually thinking about Eleanor Roosevelt because her mother was one of the great beauties of her age. And so what is it like to grow up as a young girl in that shadow? And Issa's mother is full of ideas for how Issa can be beautiful. And at one point, she actually is helping her to save money to get this special eye surgery, which actually a lot of Asian women get, to make your eyes look more Western. And she's always buying her clothes and showing her how to use cosmetics and all sorts of things. And at a certain point, I think, in the novel, her loyalty shifts. And she starts to realize that there's something about her mother that's a little desperate, a little bit sort of out of control, and that there's something about her father in his own quiet way that's actually very steady, and that she's misjudged him.
Yeah, right after that section of the book where Issa's mother is tucking her in and singing to her as she's Doris Day, we have a glimpse of her father, and he comes across to me right then as a very sympathetic character. I like him very much. It's like there's a wonderful person in here. He's so alone, and he's working so hard.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he is like very many, I think.
First
generation, especially Asian men, working very hard to achieve the American dream. Not particularly encouraged by, you know, especially the Confucian tradition to be emotive at all. I think that he finds Issa very problematic. She's the firstborn. She's very rebellious. She's not the submissive, demure sort of Korean daughter. And he's trying to sort of keep her in check. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And they don't really understand one another. But the father, we learn later, actually after his death, has a secret and has had a secret, which he has not even shared with his wife. And a lot of the book, I mean, it's called A Secondhand World, and it's really about how even when immigrants come to this country and even when they achieve the American dream, all of the trappings, that there's always a cost, there's always a downside. And for Issa's father and for the Koreans of that generation, the war was devastating, the Korean War. And a lot of things happened. They had a lot of experiences that they can't forget, even if they come to this country.
Did you draw on the stories of your parents in creating Issa's parents?
I did to a certain extent. They are not my parents, but especially there's a section in the book where Issa comes upon letters that her father has written that are about the Korean War. And it's where she discovers her father's secret. And those letters, a lot of them, I took directly from my father's memoirs. When my father decided to retire from teaching, he started writing his wartime memoirs. Very interesting, you know, physics professor, you know, he wasn't really sure about my becoming a writer. But when he tried to actually sit down and write his memoirs, he said to me, wow, you know, writing is really hard. and, you know, he ended up writing maybe 20 or 30 pages. But I used a lot of that, a lot of his experiences directly in the letters in the book.
Yeah. Writing is hard, I'm sure, but it's also very powerful. And going back to this idea of when you spoke earlier of fire, sort of it sort of gradually comes out on the page. What is it like to look back over the work and say, "Wow, are there epiphanies about?" Well, I just think I learned something new about how I see the world or how the, you know.
Well, I think that happens.
How the world works.
When you finish a first draft, you write it and then you read, when you first read the whole thing through, you start to see these things emerge. Fire is a huge part of the book. Also, there's an image of a crack in the ceiling, which carries over throughout the book. And I think what you do as a writer after the first draft is you say, okay, so I see these images emerging. How can I heighten them, make them work, you know, because they seem to already be working in this way. Mm-hmm. Or you say, you know what, that's not really working. I think I better tone that down, or that doesn't need to be there. So there's always, you know, I mean, the whole idea of, you know, the boundaries and of skin and of fire and of burns and all of that sort of just kind of flowed. And then this idea of the crack in the world, which Issa comes to see as sort of this flaw. I mean, I think a lot of it just happens because unconsciously, the deeper that you get into this imaginative world, the more it has its own logic. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the things I knew when I was starting out was I was interested in the conflict between the immigrant generation and their American-born children. Whether or not you're Korean or any other nationality or ethnicity, you know, there is always a bit of a rift. You know, there's always a generational conflict between parents and children mm-hmm. anyway, but when you add a cultural layer to that, it becomes a little more pronounced. And so this idea of a schism or of a crack sort of presented itself.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is writer Catherine Min. Her novel, Secondhand World, was published last year to critical acclaim. It was a finalist for the Penn Bingham Award. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, later this afternoon, on the 7th of November of 2007, our guest will read from her work in the author's corner of the Alana Union Bookstore. That's on the second floor of the bookstore on South Wright Street in Champaign. The reading is set for 4:30. It is part of the Carr Lecture Series. Catherine Min, actually born in Champaign-Urbana, although she didn't really grow up here, she's back in town as a University of Illinois Carr visiting author, and she'll be doing that reading this afternoon at 4:30 in the Alana Union Bookstore. How does the American dream look to this couple? There's a wonderful musing chapter called A Choir in the book, and in which Mom gets an avocado dishwasher.
Right.
But how does the dream look?
Well, you know, I mean, in some sense, this novel is about the dark side of the American dream. It's about how you can achieve everything that everyone thinks that you're supposed to get as, you know, an immigrant in this country. You know, the house and the two cars and the two-car garage and all of that. And yet there's always a cost. And I think, you know, for Issa's mother, she just kind of loves the consumerism. You know, she wants to have the house just perfect and you know, all of the furniture and all of the appliances and everything. The avocado dishwasher obviously becomes a huge deal in the book because you know, she wants so much to have, and of course it's the late 70s, so avocado would be the
right
color.
Or Harvest Gold.
Or yes, exactly. it is the dishwasher that ends up, you know, quite unwittingly being sort of the means of her son's death. And I think, you know, again, I wasn't consciously thinking of it, and yet you know, when I look at it now, it makes total sense that, you know, it's this consumerism, this sort of giddy kind of, you know, materialism that she gets caught up in. Issa's mother is very unfortunate in that she always tends to be sort of looking at the wrong thing or maybe perhaps not deep enough. And so this dishwasher actually ends up being sort of the means of the first tragedy that hits Issa's life. Mm.
The chapters of the novels are very evocative. They're loaded with detail and they're really rich. Congratulations on that. They're also quite short. How does their brevity work in terms of how all these stories within the novel unfold?
Yeah, you know, I tell people what's interesting is, you know, I think I'm temperamentally a short story writer, not a novelist. And so I had to trick myself into writing a novel. And the way I did that was by writing these very short chapters. I was thinking about the great novel Mrs. Bridge by Evan Cannell, which is a series of very short vignettes that sort of accrue in meaning until you really establish this woman's mm-hmm. character. And so I felt like I had to kind of sneak up on it. And I wrote these short chapters until I had enough of them. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe I can write a novel. And then after I started to really shape it, I realized that the short novels worked because here's a girl, 18 years old, is, you know, recovering from a fire that killed her parents, has been in a burn unit, and that the whole novel is the telling of how this fire came to be. And so it's told sort of in this long flashback, and that the only way that Issa could really tell the story would be to glance at it just very briefly, sort of, you know, peripherally, and sort of start with the things that were the least threatening, and then finally getting to, you know, what really happened that night.
Yeah. That's how you survive something.
Right. Exactly.
Survivors aren't buried.
No. They keep walking around.
Yeah. What are your short stories like?
You know, my short stories have dealt a lot with this generational difference between especially Korean fathers and Korean American daughters. And in fact, after I finished Secondhand World, I vowed that I would never again write a story or a novel about this particular kind of, you know, parental relationship, because I feel like I've said everything that I needed to say about it.
Yeah.
So now I'm moving on. I actually haven't written a short story in a long time because I'm working on another novel. But I tend to write stories about Korean fathers and Korean American daughters. I write stories about the attraction to the other, this idea that, you know, we are drawn to foreignness in an interesting way,
mm-hmm.
to what we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And also interested, and this is very much in Secondhand World, the idea of intimacy and how far you can push intimacy. In this book, Issa's always pushing intimacy. And what happens often is that if you push it too far, it goes away. And that's one of the things that Issa learns the hard way.
Mm-hmm. It seems that there's a fair amount of this kind of, you know, a magnetism, and then if you know, the feeling when you have two magnets and you hold them together and they spring apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that happens to her a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, Issa she feels like an outsider in, you know, with her peers because she's the only Asian. And also, not only because she's the only Asian, but because of the death of her brother, she feels like there's this grief that sort of has acted as a pall over her family. And she feels like an outsider in her family because her father adores her mother. Her mother is, you know, at first really stricken with grief and then sort of goes off and does her own thing, goes back to school. And she feels always alone. And I think that that's one of the things. There's a point in the book where she says she has a realization that she will always be the odd person out, mm-hmm. that she will always feel the solitariness no matter where she is or who she's with.
You said, you know, a moment ago, you said we're drawn to foreignness. On the other hand, Issa is so picked on.
Mm-hmm.
She's bullied. How can the two coexist? Why do you suppose that happens?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting. I mean, actually, you know, you're either drawn to foreignness or
repulsed by it or
scared of it. She gets bullied, you know, on the bus. It's the time of the Vietnam War. So, you know, people don't know the difference between, you know, Koreans or Vietnamese or Japanese or Chinese. So she gets picked on for that. She is like many Asian girls, you know, maybe underdeveloped physically. So she gets picked on,
yeah.
you know, for those reasons. She's also very bookish. I mean, she is, like I was, incredibly interested in literature and language. You know, I make a big point of having her. She reads the dictionary, you know, and writes down words and definitions. I mean, she's odd even, you know, in that way. So that she's not the kind of person who's going to be on the cheerleading team and be popular. And yet there is also this element of foreignness that is intriguing. And I would argue that some of those boys who are teasing her really are actually kind of fascinated mm-hmm. by her, but don't have the maturity to sort of really express it in any other way. It's an exoticness. It's something that sets her apart. And I think that as, you know, at least in my life, I know that as I got older and more comfortable in my own skin, I was able to own that more so that it became sort of a positive thing. I think that Issa probably will get there. But for obvious reasons, she's had setbacks, and she's not going to get there right away.
Once you're finished with a story, once you're finished with this novel, do you keep wondering about the characters, or is the book closed, so to speak?
You know, I wish Issa really well. I made her go through a lot, and she's only 18 when the novel ends, and I like to think that she's going to go on and, you know, be able to survive, and not just survive, but thrive, and learn from these experiences. But someone asked me the other night at a reading whether or not I would ever write a sequel, and I know that I will not.
Yeah.
I feel like Issa, to my mind, gets to go live her life, and I'm really interested in new things now.
Right, right. It's interesting when I talk with writers, it seems that some of them are reluctant to let it go, and some of them are like, enough. You know, I've taken you this far. You're on your own now.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
I put you into the hands of readers. Go forth.
Right.
Yeah. So what are you working on at the moment?
My new novel is called The Fetishist. I'm about 100 pages into it. And it's about a middle-aged Caucasian man who has an Asian fetish. He's a string musician, a violinist, and what better place to have an Asian fetish than in the world of classical music, because every other string musician is a young Asian woman. And I was interested in exploring this whole idea of Asian fetishism. There are many, many men, Caucasian, African American, who have a thing for Asian women, and I've encountered many of them, and I just wanted to sort of figure out what that was about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a dark comedy, and it's something very different from Secondhand World. I'm really enjoying working on it, but it's a challenge.
Yeah. In the meantime, you're also teaching at University of North Carolina at Asheville. What are your favorite courses to teach?
Well, interesting. I love teaching. Right now I'm teaching it's a first year composition course for freshmen, which I really enjoy. And it's a course that, you know, everybody says, oh, you know, you never want to teach that. But my freshmen are terrific. They're lively. They're open-minded. I'm having a great time teaching them. I'm also teaching Asian American literature, which I enjoy very much because I get to teach books that I really love, like Woman Warrior by Maxine Hong Kingston, and I teach Chang Rui Lee and Jessica Hagedorn. I really love sharing that literature with my students. And then I teach fiction writing workshops, which are always, always interesting because, you know, most of the work is generated by the students. I love to write, and I'm lucky that I have the ability or the opportunity to share that passion for literature and for writing with young people who are also very excited about it.
What do those students have to say about what it feels like when they're writing?
You know, it's all over the map, I think. You know, some of my students write prolifically. Some of them, you know, have a really hard time, you know, just finishing one story. Some of them are very serious about their work, and it shows. Some of them, you know, I don't think they're ever going to really write outside of class. But they all share an appreciation for the written word. Which is wonderful.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Time's flown by. We've used it all up. Catherine Minn, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
I've really enjoyed it. Secondhand World will be out in a paperback edition in January. And our guest, if you'd like to meet her this afternoon, if you're in the area, by all means, get out to the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon. Get to the Author's Corner. That's on the second floor of the bookstore on South Wright Street in Champaign. Our guest, Catherine Minn, will do a reading, and that is set for 4 o'clock this afternoon. 4:30, excuse me. I did it right all the other times. 4:30, but thank you for speaking up, because I hate it when I screw up. So anyway, this is a part of the Carr Lecture Series. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you.